there's a small thing you can also attribute to that. So linked to scarcity and maybe renewability, because we all thought that oil was endless with all of us. And so scarcity only exists at the point that it happens. And
yeah.
Usually that happens later than that you could see it coming. And I think...
Then there's also the artificial controls on these resources. The OECD, no wait, the OPEC countries saying, "Oh no, we're only going to sell this many barrels this year."
But is it artificial because it's theirs?
Oh, well, I mean, they are scarcifying something that everybody else needs. I mean, I'm not saying that the oil in the ground isn't scarce, but they definitely have a lot of regulations and you know, a regulatory capability or capacity.
Yeah, but it's the opposite situation as the airport situation.
Yeah.
They're sitting on oil.
Yeah.
And they can do with it what they want.
Yeah.
Create scarcity or not. Mm-hmm.
And we kind of need to have to deal with it. We can, you know, find something that isn't scarce.
Yeah. Just wanted to mention, you use a category rivalrous goods.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know whether you're aware of, others might also be interested in, the concept of positional consumption. This was called a term for positional goods, as opposed to public goods. An economist called Fred Hirsch wrote a book called Social Limits to Growth in the 1970s, early 1970s. And that's really very, very important when I was concerned about the material economy, because a lot of things are turned into positional. Mm-hmm. Like, even a job can be turned into a position of good. Like, if you limit the number of jobs for doctors that there are, then that becomes an object of consumption. And people consume a lot. They produce an awful lot of consumption is driven by the need to get your child into university, a good university where they can become a doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you prioritise education, you know, it then becomes... It's part of all the engines of inequality. Mm-hmm. And
I've never heard it. What's the name?
Fred Hirsch.
Fred Hirsch.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll have to remember that somehow.
It's also in Daniel Bell, Towards the Post-Industrial Society, when he thinks about what will be scarce in the with the abundance of information.
Mm-hmm.
He mentions positions. And,
okay. Yeah.
And he has quite elaborate discussion.
I
don't agree with the book, but it was visionary nonetheless.
There are ways to deal with position, positionary goods. For example, one of the ideas there is peer-to-peer education, where I've always really hated the education system in that it forces me to come and sit down at lectures day after day after day, and at the end of 3 years I suddenly magically get an education. You know, I mean, of course it's not like that, but the way the degrees are structured, you don't get an education until you've suddenly got the paper. And you know, I kind of dislike that. So the idea of peer-to-peer education for me is partially the idea of people teaching each other, and you know, that way we're kind of ridding ourselves of the positionary things in education by saying, if you want to learn something, find somebody who can teach it to you.
That was Smari McCarthy, a free software activist from Iceland, speaking at the 4th Okanox Conference, Free Software and Beyond, the World of Peer Production, held in Manchester, England, in March 2009. To find out more about the Okanox organization, an international group of people seeking real-world implementations of peer-to-peer production, Google Okanox. Let me spell it for you. Their URL is much too long for radio. So just Google this. OEKONUX. OEKONUX. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN, Nashville, WUOW, Oneonta, KRBS, Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren.
More shadow work in the factory, greasy up my clothes. The more shadow work in the factory, splinters in my toes. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away. The more shall I hear the bosses say, boys, you better doff. No more shall I hear the bosses say, spinners, you better clean off. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away. More shall I hear the drummer wheels rolling over my head. When factories are hard at work, I'll be in my bed. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away. No more shall I wear the old black dress, greasy all around. No more shall I wear the old black bonnet with holes all in the crown. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away. Shall I see the super come all dressed up so proud? For I know I'll marry a country boy when the year is out. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away.
To conclude the program, I'm pleased to bring you an encore from another little-known visionary who, at least to me, has dug deeply into the roots of our many present problems, yet has resisted despair by reaching for a vision which he has articulated in detail in his recent book, The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and the Convergence of Crises that is Birthing the Transition. Charles Eisenstein writes of himself, "I was born in 1967 and was a very sensitive, intellectual, and dreamy child. I was always consumed by questions like, where did I come from? Why am I here? Where am I going? So, of course, embedded as I was in a culture that sees science and reason as the source of truth, I tried to figure out the answers. I graduated from Yale University with a degree in mathematics and philosophy, but my development of reason and intellect brought me no closer to any truth I really cared about. I didn't know what I was searching for, but I knew that none of the usual options life presents to a Yale graduate attracted me. I went to Taiwan, learned Chinese, and soon found myself working as a translator. I spent most of my 20s there, educating myself broadly in Eastern spiritual traditions. I also read voraciously books on health, nutrition, physics, and biology. Translation led to other business opportunities, and I became familiar with this dimension of the human experience. In Taiwan, I met my dear friend and ex-wife Patsy, with whom I have three children, all boys. In my late 20s, I entered what was to become a long period of intensifying crisis. It started when all my professional work became intolerable. It became excruciating to do work I didn't care about. Even though a million reasons told me why it was irresponsible, impractical, and foolish to quit, I eventually could not make myself do it anymore. An irrepressible feeling, I am not here to be doing this, took control of my life. So I entered a long period of searching. I spent time teaching yoga, learning about herbs, and teaching at Penn State's Department of Science, Technology, and Society. All of these endeavors have contributed to my present and future, but none were really me. I'll read you from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Introduction. More than any other species, human beings are gifted with the power to manipulate our environment and the ability to accumulate and transmit knowledge across generations. The first of these gifts we call technology, the other we call culture. They are central to our humanity. Accumulating over thousands of years, culture and technology have brought us into a separate human realm. We live more than any animal, surrounded by our own artifacts. Amongst these are works of surpassing beauty, complexity, and power. Human creations that could not have existed, could not even have been conceived in the times of our forebears. Seldom do we pause to appreciate the audacity of our achievements. Objects as mundane as a compact disc, a video cell phone, an airplane would have seemed fantastical only a few centuries ago. We have created a realm of magic and miracles. At the same time, it's quite easy to see technology and culture not as gifts, but as a curse. After millennia of development, the power to manipulate the environment has become the power to destroy it, while the ability to transmit knowledge transmits as well a legacy of hatred, injustice, and violence. Today, as both the destruction and the violence reach a feverish crescendo, few can deny that the world is in a state of crisis. Opinions vary as to its exact nature. Some people say it is primarily ecological. Others say it is a moral crisis, a social, economic, or political crisis, a health crisis, even a spiritual crisis. There is, however, little disagreement that the crisis is of human origin, hence despair. Is the present ruination of the world built into our humanity? Is genocide and ecocide the inevitable price of civilization's magnificence? Need the most sublime achievements of art, music, literature, science, and technology be built upon the wreckage of the natural world and the misery of its inhabitants? Can the microchip come without the oil slick, the strip mine, the toxic waste dump? Under the shadow of every Chartres cathedral, must there be women burning at the stake? In other words, can the gift of technology and culture somehow be separated from the curse? The dashed utopian dreams of the last few centuries leave little hope. Despite the miracles we have produced, people across the ideological spectrum, from Christian fundamentalists to environmental activists, share a foreboding that the world is in grave and growing peril. Temporary localized improvements cannot hide the ambient wrongness that pervades the warp and woof of modern society, and often our personal lives as well. We might manage each immediate problem and control every foreseeable risk, but an underlying disquiet remains. I am referring simply to the feeling something is wrong around here. Something so fundamentally wrong that centuries of our best and brightest efforts to create a better world have failed or even backfired. As this realization sinks in, we respond with despair, cynicism, numbness, or detachment. Yet no matter how complete the despair, no matter how bitter the cynicism, a possibility beckons of a world more beautiful and a life more magnificent than what we know today. Though we may rationalize it, it is not rational. We become aware of it in moments, gaps in the rush and press of modern life. These moments come to us alone in nature or with a baby, making love, playing with children, caring for a dying person, making music for the sake of music or beauty for the sake of beauty. At such times, a simple and easy joy shows us the futility of the vast, life-consuming program of management and control. We intuit also that something similar is possible collectively. Some of us may have experienced it when we find ourselves cooperating naturally and effortlessly, instruments of a purpose greater than ourselves that paradoxically makes us individually more, not less, when we abandon ourselves to it. It is what musicians are referring to when they say, the music played the band. Another way of being is possible, and it is right in front of us, closer than close. That much is transparently certain. Yet it slips away so easily that we could hardly believe it could be the foundation of life. So we relegate it to an afterlife and call it heaven, or we relegate it to the future and call it utopia. When nanotechnology solves our problems, when we all learn to be nice to each other, when I'm finally not so busy. Either way, we set it apart from this world and this life, and thereby deny its practicality and its reality in the here and now. Yet the knowledge of that life is more than just this. Yet the knowledge of that life is more than just this cannot be suppressed, not forever. Whether for myself or for the world, I share with dreamers, utopians, and teenagers an unreasonable intuition of a magnificent potential that life and the world can be more than we have made of them. What error, then, what delusion has led us to accept the lesser lives and the lesser world we find ourselves in today? What has rendered us helpless to resist the ugliness, pollution, injustice, and downright horror that has risen to engulf the planet in the last few centuries? What calamity has so resigned us to it that we call this the human condition? Those moments of love, freedom, serenity, play, what power has made us believe these are but respites from real life? Inspired by such moments, I've spent the last 10 years trying to understand what keeps us and what keeps me from the better world that our hearts tell us must exist. To my endless amazement, I keep discovering a common root underneath all the diverse crises of the modern age. Underlying the vast swath of ruin our civilization has carved out is not human nature, but the opposite, human nature denied. This denial of human nature rests in turn upon an illusion, a misconception of self and world. We have defined ourselves as other than what we are, as discrete subjects separate from each other and separate from the world around us. In a way, this is good news. In this book, I will describe the profound changes that will flow and are already flowing from the reconception of the self that is underway. The bad news is that our present conception of self is so deeply woven into our civilization, into our technology and culture, that its abandonment can only come with the collapse of much that is familiar. This is what the present convergence of crises portends. Everything I wrote in the preceding paragraph about our civilization also applies to each of us individually. Saints and mystics have tried for thousands of years to teach us how we are trapped in a delusion about who we are. This delusion inevitably brings about suffering and eventually a crisis that can only be resolved through a collapse, a surrender, an opening to a state of being beyond previous self-limitation. You are not, they tell us, a flesh-encapsulated ego, and lasting happiness can never result from pursuing that ego's agenda. These spiritual teachings have helped me to realize, at least partway, my intuitions of what work, love, human relationship, and health can be. They are not the main subject of this book. However, nor do I claim to exemplify them in my own life. Nonetheless, the shift in our collective self-conception is intimately related to a parallel shift in our individual self-conception. In other words, there is a spiritual dimension to the planetary crisis. As this planetary crisis invades our individual lives, unavoidably, neither the personal nor the collective misconception of who we are will remain tenable. Each mirrors the other in its origins, its consequences, and its resolution. That is why this book interweaves the story of humanity's separation from nature with the story of our individual alienation from life, nature, spirit, and self. Despite my faith that life is meant to be more, little voices whisper in my ear that I am crazy. Nothing is amiss, they say. This is just the way things are. The rising tide of human misery and ecological destruction, as old as civilization, is simply the human condition, an inevitable result of built-in human flaws like selfishness and laziness. Since you can't change it, be thankful for your good fortune in avoiding it. The misery of much of the planet is a warning, say the voices, to protect me and mine, impelling me to maximize my security. Besides, it couldn't be as bad as I think. If all that stuff were true, about the ecological destruction, the genocide, the starving children, and the whole litany of impending crises, then wouldn't everyone be in an uproar about it? The normalcy of the routine surrounding me here in America tells me it couldn't be that bad. That little voice echoes throughout the culture. Every advertising flyer, every celebrity news item, every product catalog, every hyped-up sports event carries the subtext. You can afford to care about this. A man in a burning house wouldn't care about these things. That our culture does care about them almost exclusively implies that our house is not burning down. The forests are not dying. The deserts are not spreading. The atmosphere is not heating. Children are not starving. Torturers are not going free. Whole ethnicities are not being exterminated. These crimes against humanity and crimes against nature couldn't really be happening. Probably they have been exaggerated. In any event, they are happening somewhere else. Our society will figure out solutions before the calamities of the third world affect me. See, no one else is worried, are they? Life hums on, as usual. As for my intuition of magnificent possibilities for my own life, well, my expectations are too high. Grow up, the voices say. Life is just like this. What right do I have to expect the unreasonable magnificence whose possibility certain moments have shown me? No, it is my intuitions that are not to be trusted. The examples of what life is surround me and define what is normal. Do I see anyone around me whose work is their joy, whose time is their own, whose love is their passion? It can't happen. Be thankful, say the voices, that my job is reasonably stimulating, that I feel in love at least once in a while, that the pain is manageable and life's uncertainties under control. Let good enough be good enough. Sure, life can be a drag, but at least I can afford to escape it sometimes. Life is about work, self-discipline, responsibility. But if I get these out of the way quickly and efficiently, I can enjoy vacations, entertainment, weekends, maybe even early retirement. Listening to these voices, is it any wonder that for many years I devoted most of my energy and vitality to the escapes from life? Is it any wonder that so many of my students at Penn State look forward already at age 21 to retirement? If life and the world are just this, we are left no choice but to make the best of it, to be more efficient, to achieve better security, to get life's uncertainties under control. There are voices that speak to this too. They are the evangelists of technology and self-improvement, who urge us to improve the human condition basically by trying harder. My inner evangelist tells me, get my life under control, to work out every day, to organize my time more efficiently, to watch my diet, to be more disciplined, to try harder to be a good person. On the collective level, the same attitude says that perhaps the next generation of material and social technologies, new medicines, better laws, faster computers, solar power, nanotechnology, will finally succeed in improving our lot. We will become more efficient, more intelligent, more capable, and finally have the capacity to solve humanity's age-old problems. Today, for more and more people, these voices are ringing hollow. Words like high-tech and modern lose their cachet as a multiplicity of crises converge upon our planet. If we are fortunate, we might for a time prevent these crises from invading our personal lives. Yet as the environment continues to deteriorate, as job security evaporates, as the international situation worsens, as new incurable diseases appear, as the pace of change accelerates, it seems impossible to rest at ease. The world grows more competitive, more dangerous, less hospitable to easy living, and security comes with greater and greater effort. And even when temporary security is won, a latent anxiety lurks within the fortress walls, a mute unease in the background of modern life. It pervades technological society and only intensifies as the pace of technology quickens. We begin to grow hopeless as our solutions, new technologies, new laws, more education, trying harder, only seem to worsen our problems. For many activists, hopelessness gives way to despair as, despite their best efforts, catastrophe looms ever closer. This book explains why trying harder can never work. Our best efforts are grounded in the same mode of being that is responsible for the crisis in the first place. As Audre Lorde put it, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. Soon, though, this mode of being will come to an end, to be replaced by a profoundly different understanding of the self and a profoundly different relationship between human and nature. This book is about the gathering revolution in human beingness. When we say that the planetary crisis is of human and not natural origin, what do we mean? Human beings are, after all, mammals, biological creatures, no less natural than any other. In a sense, there can be no distinction between human and nature, because human beings are a part of nature, and everything we do is therefore natural. However, we do distinguish. We recognize in nature a kind of harmony, balance, authenticity, and beauty lacking in the world of technology. Think of the connotations of the word artificial. Whether in fact or in perception, we modern humans live in a way that is no longer natural. At the crux of the human-nature distinction is technology, the product of the human hand. While other animals do make and use tools, no other species has our capacity to remake or destroy the physical environment, to control nature's processes, or transcend nature's limitations. In the mental and spiritual realm, the counterpart of technology is culture, which modifies and even supersedes human nature, in the same way technology modifies physical nature. In thus mastering nature with technology, and mastering human nature with culture, we distinguish ourselves from the rest of life, establishing a separate human realm. Believing this to be a good thing, we think of this separation as an ascent in which we have risen above our animal origins. Hence our favorite term for the millennia-long accumulation of culture and technology, progress. It is separation, then, in the form of technology and culture, that defines us as human. As well, it is separation that has generated the converging crises of today's world. People of a religious persuasion might attribute the fundamental crisis to a separation from God. People of an ecological persuasion to a separation from nature. People engaged in social activism might focus on the dissolution of community, which is a separation from each other. We might also investigate the psychological dimension, the separation from lost parts of ourselves. For good or ill, it is separation that has made us what we are. Through long and tortuous pathways, these forms of separation have created the world we know today. our intuitions that life and the world are meant to more reflect the ultimate illusoriness of that separation. But it is a powerful illusion, having generated the converging crises we see today in politics, the environment, medicine, education, the economy, religion, and many other realms. In this book, I will trace the pathways to these crises. Constantly, I'm amazed how the same fundamental misconception of self underlies phenomena as apparently unconnected as the war in Iraq, intellectual property, antibiotic resistance, acid rain, ethnic cleansing, junk mail, suburban sprawl, and declining U.S. literacy. No, I'm not going to blame it all on capitalism, for our economic system, too, is more a symptom than a cause of separation. The root and the epitome of separation is the discrete, isolated self of modern perception, the I am of Descartes, the economic man of Adam Smith, the individual phenotype of Darwinian competition for resources, the skin-encapsulated ego of Alan Watts. It is a self conditionally dependent on, but fundamentally separate from the other, from nature and other people. Seeing ourselves as discrete and separate beings, we naturally seek to manipulate the not-self to our best advantage. Technology in particular is predicated on some kind of individuation or conceptual separation from the environment, because it takes the physical world as its object of manipulation and control. Technology in effect says, let us make the world better. If, as I wrote above, our self-conception as discrete and separate beings is an illusion, then the whole ascent of humanity, the species of culture and technology, is based on an illusion as well. That is why the implications of our present reconceiving of ourselves are so profound, promising no less than a radical redefinition of what it is to be human, how we relate to one another, and how we relate to the world. Not only is technology based on a conceptual separation from nature, but it also reinforces that separation. Technology distances us from nature and insulates us from her rhythms. For example, most Americans' lives are little affected by the seasons of the year. We eat the same food year-round, shipped in from California. Air conditioning keeps us cool in the summer, heating warm in the winter. Natural physical limitations of muscle and bone no longer limit how far we can travel, how high we can build, or the distance at which we can communicate. Each advance in technology distances us from nature, yes, but also frees us from natural limitations. Each advance in technology distances us from nature, yes, but also frees us from natural limitations, hence the ascent. But how can all these improvements add up to the world we find ourselves in today? We're faced with a paradox. On the one hand, technology and culture are fundamental to the separation of humans from nature, a separation that is at the root of the converging crises of the present age. On the other hand, technology and culture explicitly seek to improve on nature, to make life easier, safer, and more comfortable. Who could deny that the first digging stick was an improvement over hands and fingernails? Who could deny that fire keeps us warmer and medicine healthier than the primitive living in a state of nature? At least that is what these technologies intend. But have we actually made the world better? If not, then why has technology not achieved its intended purpose? Again, how can a series of incremental improvements add up to crisis? Chapter 1 begins to answer these questions by describing a grave constitutional flaw in the very premise of technology. And beyond that, in technology's generalization as the program of control, by considering it through the lens of addiction, we will see that the despair mentioned above is justified, that our entire approach to problem-solving renders us helpless to do anything but worsen the gathering crisis. Like an animal caught in quicksand, the harder we struggle, the faster we sink. Chapter 2 describes how we got into this quagmire to begin with. It digs far beneath the usual culprits of industry and agriculture to identify the origins of separation in everything that makes us human. Language, art, measure, religion, and technology, even Stone Age technology. These have built upon each other, converging into the tidal wave of alienation and misery that engulfs the planet today. Nonetheless, by tracing the separation responsible for our current crisis to prehistorical or even pre-human times, we begin to see separation not as a monstrously wrong turn, to use John Zerzan's words, but as an organic inevitability leading, perhaps, to a new phase of human and natural development. It was with the scientific revolution of Galileo, Newton, Bacon, and Descartes that the ideology of separation received its full articulation. We call this articulation science. Chapter 3 describes how the conceptual distinction between self and world is built into our very vocabulary of thought. The methods and techniques of modern science, along with that entire mode of thought we call rational, objective, or scientific, reinforce the regime of separation, even when we try to ameliorate it. The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. An example of this is the urge to save the environment or conserve natural resources, locutions that reaffirm an external environment fundamentally separate from ourselves, upon which we are only conditionally dependent. This echoes the classical scientific cosmology, which, though obsolete, still forms the basis of our intuition, that we are isolated, separate beings, gazing out upon an objective universe of impersonal forces and generic masses. Meanwhile, religion, too, is shown to be complicit in the de-spiritualization of the world that we associate with science. By retreating into an ever-shrinking, non-material realm of the spirit, or by flagrantly denying elementary scientific observations, religion has effectively ceded the material world to the science of Newton and Descartes. With spirit separate from matter and God separate from creation, we are left impotent and alone in Fritjof Capra's Newtonian world machine. After language and measure have labeled and quantified the world and science made it an object, the next step is to turn it into a commodity. Chapter 4 describes the vast consequences of the conversion of all wealth, social, cultural, natural, and spiritual, into money. Phenomena as diverse as the dissolution of community, the weakening of friendship, the rise of intellectual property, the shortening of attention spans, the professionalization of music and art, and the destruction of the environment have a common source in our system of money and property, which in turn arises from and reinforces our self-conception as discrete and separate beings in an objective universe of others. To simply try to stop being so greedy will never be enough, because selfishness is built in at an impossibly deep level. This selfishness, however, is not human nature, but rather human nature denied, human nature contorted by our misconception of who we are. The consequences of our fundamental misunderstanding of self and world, introduced in Chapter 1, are portrayed in full flower in Chapter 5. Our opposition to nature and human nature, implicit in technology's mission to improve them, can only result in a world under control. Manifesting in every realm, from religion to law to education to medicine, we maintain the world under control only at an ever greater price. Helplessly, we respond to each failure of control with more of it, postponing but ultimately intensifying the eventual day of reckoning. As a social, cultural, natural and spiritual capital of Chapter 4 is exhausted, as our technology proves helpless to avert the impending crises, the collapse of the world under control looms closer. It is this collapse, which the present convergence of crises portends, that will set the stage for the Age of Reunion, described in Chapter 7. While classical science presents the illusion of separation as fact, scientific developments of the last century have rendered the Newtonian world machine obsolete. Chapter 6 describes how the crumbling of the objective, reductionistic, deterministic worldview opens the door not just to a new mode of technology, but also to a spirituality that sees sacredness, purpose, and meaning as fundamental properties of matter. Part of our separation has been to see spirit as distinct from matter, either imposed from the outside by an extra-natural god or a mere figment of our imagination. Assiduously avoiding New Age clichés about quantum mechanics, Chapter 6 draws on recent developments in physics, yes, but also evolutionary biology, ecology, mathematics, and genetics. It lays the scientific groundwork for a reuniting of matter and spirit, as well as the reuniting of man and nature, self and other, work and play, and all the other dualisms of the age of separation. We are witnessing in our time the intensification of separation to its breaking point. The convergence of crises mentioned above is birthing a new era. I call it the Age of Reunion. Chapter 7 portrays what life might look like, no longer founded on the illusion of the discrete and separate self. Drawing on the new scientific paradigms of Chapter 6, it describes a system of money, economics, medicine, education, science, and technology that seeks not the control of or transcendence of nature, but our fuller participation in nature. Yet it is not a return to the past, nor a divestiture of the gifts of hand and mind that make us human. The Age of Reunion is rather a new human estate, a return to the harmony and wholeness of the hunter-gatherer, but at a higher level of organization and a higher level of consciousness. It does not reverse, but rather integrates the entire course of separation, which we may begin to see as an adventure of self-discovery instead of a terrible blunder. Although I affirm the general growing premonition of our civilization's impending crash, nonetheless, the enormous misery and ruination we have wrought is not in vain. Look at New York City's skyline or a close-up of an integrated circuit board. Could it all be for naught? Could the incredible complexity, furious activity, and vast scientific knowledge of our civilization merely be, to paraphrase Shakespeare, a sound and a fury signifying nothing? Following my intuition to the contrary, in Chapter 8, I describe what I believe to be the cosmic purpose of our ascent to the furthest reaches of separation. Drawing on religious, mythological, and cosmological metaphors, Chapter 8 puts the tides of separation and reunion into a vast context in which none of our efforts to create a world of wholeness and beauty, however doomed they seem right now, are futile, foolish, or insignificant. Even in the darkest days, everyone senses a higher possibility, a world that was meant to be, life as we were meant to live it. Glimpses of this world of wholeness and beauty have inspired idealists for thousands of years, an echo in our collective psyche as notions of heaven, an age of Aquarius or Eden, a once and future golden age. As mystics have taught throughout the ages, such a world is closer than close, within us and amongst us, yet as well it is impossibly far off, forever inaccessible to any effort arising from our present self-conception. To reach it, our present self-conception and the relationship to the world it implies must collapse, so we might discover our true selves, and therefore our true role, function, and relationship to the universe. This book exposes the futility, the fraudulence, and ultimately the baselessness of the program to control the world, to label it and number it, to categorize it and own it, to transcend nature and human nature. Thus exposed, that program will loosen its grip on us, so that we may let go of it before it consumes every last vestige of life and beauty on Earth. The extensive scientific chapters are there to persuade you that the mechanistic, objective world of the discrete and separate self is not reality but a projection, merely the image of our own confusion. The ascent of humanity is not merely another critique of modern society, and the solutions I explore are not along the lines of, we should do this and we shouldn't do that. Who the hell is we? You and I are just you and I. And that is why so much political discourse about what we must do is so disheartening. That is why so many activists experience such despair, such despondency. You and I, no matter how much we agree with each other, are not the we of collective action, as in we need to live more sustainably, or we need to pursue diplomatic options. I find many people resonating with my intuition of a wrongness about life and the world as we know it. But their response is not empowered indignation. It is despair, helplessness, impotence. What can one person do? Actually, these emotions, too, are symptoms of the same separation behind all our crises. When I am a discrete and separate individual, whatever I do makes little difference. But this logic is actually founded upon an illusion. We, you and I, are actually powerful beyond imagining. Because the illusion of separateness is crumbling. The alternative I offer is practical, natural, and indeed inevitable. The ruin and violence of the present age do not typify an immutable human condition. They originate in a confusion about self and world, a confusion embodied in our fundamental scientific and religious principles. They originate in a confusion about self and world, a confusion embodied in our fundamental scientific and religious principles and applied in every aspect of modern life, from politics to economics to medicine and education. Social and environmental destruction is an inevitable consequence of this worldview, just as rejuvenation and wholeness have been and will be. The consequence of a different worldview, one that has roots in primitive culture and religion, and is the inescapable yet heretofore generally unrealized implication of 20th century science. Our current self-world distinction and its consequent parsing of all the world into discrete entities has run the course of its usefulness as the dominant paradigm. Our individuation as individuals and as a species separate from nature is complete. In fact, it is overcomplete. What started with agriculture and even before, with pre-human gropings toward the technologies of stone and fire, has reached its outer limit. It has taken us far, this separation. It has fueled the creation of wonders. To the extent that the separation is an illusion, and that we too are part of nature, that illusion has unleashed a new force of nature that has transformed the planet. But if the human gifts of hand and mind, are natural too, then what happened to the harmony, beauty, and authenticity whose absence everyone can feel in the world of technology? Can we ever attain that human condition that we sense is possible in those moments of spiritual connection? This book will explore the extremes of separation we have reached, as well as the potential reunion that lies in the fulfillment and not the abandonment of the gifts that make us human. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Chapter 1, The Triumph of Technology. Gee whiz, the future. For at least 200 years now, futurists have been predicting the imminent rise of a technological utopia, drawing on the premise that technology will free humankind from labor, suffering, disease, and possibly even death. Underlying this view is a defining story of our civilization, that science has brought us from a state of ignorance to an increasing understanding of the physical universe, and that technology has brought us from a state of dependency on nature's whims to an increasing mastery of the material world. Someday in the future, goes the story, our understanding and control will be complete. At the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, it seemed obvious that the age of coal would usher in a new era of leisure. In one industry after another, a machine was able to do the work of 1,000 men. Soon the day would come when all work was mechanized. If a machine could do the work of 1,000 men, then it stood to reason that each man would only have to work 1/1000th as hard. As the Industrial Revolution progressed, it soon became apparent that most people were doing more work, not less. True, the spinning jenny and power loom freed millions of women from the tedium of spinning their own thread and weaving their own cloth, but replaced that tedium with the horrors of the textile mill. Similarly, the steel foundry replaced the blacksmith shop. The railroad car replaced the horse and cart. The steam shovel replaced the pick and spade. Yet in terms of working hours, working conditions, danger and monotony, the Industrial Revolution had not lived up to the promise encoded in the term labor-saving device. The age of leisure, where coal-powered machines would do the work while people looked on and reaped the benefits, was going to arrive later than expected. The futurists did not give up hope, though. Maybe they had only been premature. They hadn't realized that coal wasn't enough. It was the age of electricity that would finally usher in technotopia. Modern man would live in a paradise of electrified comfort. The spate of inventions that followed the harnessing of electricity made it obvious that we had the power to eliminate most forms of work still largely associated with physical labor and bring unprecedented leisure to the masses. Almost no one doubted the power, the inevitability, and the desirability of technological transcendence of our natural limitations. Hence the slogan of the 1933 World's Fair, "Science invents, industry applies, man conforms." The ascent of technology carries an aura of inevitability, destiny, and triumph. As John von Neumann put it, technological possibilities are irresistible to man. If man can go to the moon, he will. If he can control the climate, he will. What fool would doubt it or stand in the way of progress? In the decades after World War II, all signs pointed toward the impending triumph of technology. The 1940s and 1950s witnessed revolutionary innovations in medicine, including antibiotics and vaccines that apparently brought an end to the mass killers that had haunted civilization for centuries. Flush with victory, medical researchers confidently predicted the imminent end of all disease. Surely cancer, heart disease, and arthritis would succumb to modern medicine, just as polio, smallpox, cholera, and plague already had. In agriculture, chemical fertilizers brought record harvests and the seeming promise of an unlimited cornucopia in the future, which would be protected from insect depredation by the new classes of pesticides, such as DDT, lauded as nothing short of miraculous. Soon, it seemed, agriculture would no longer depend on nature at all, as modern chemistry improved on the soil and modern breeding improved on the organism. Also around this time, atomic power offered the potential of virtually unlimited energy, electricity, quote, too cheap to meter. Just as oil and coal had supplanted animal power, so would atomic energy increase our energy supply by several more orders of magnitude. And as the 60s drew to a close, space, the final frontier, also succumbed to human conquest, first with the orbiting of the Earth and culminating with the moon landing of 1969. Atomic Energy Commissioner Louis Strauss summed up the vision nicely in 1954. Quote, "It is not too much to expect that our children will enjoy in their homes electrical energy too cheap to meter. We'll know of great periodic regional famines in the world only as matters of history. We'll travel effortlessly over the seas and under them and through the air with a minimum of danger and at great speeds. And we'll experience a lifespan far longer than ours as disease yields and man comes to understand what causes him to age." Close quote. Meanwhile, the horrors of the Industrial Revolution seemed to be in retreat. Its hellish slums, child labor, disease epidemics, 16-hour workdays, and starvation wages. The blossoming new sciences of economics, psychology, and sociology promised to bring the same wonders to the social universe that the hard sciences had brought to the physical universe. The goal of a rational society, engineered for maximum happiness, just as the machine is engineered for maximum efficiency, was just around the corner. So we cannot blame ourselves for believing that technology would indeed usher in the golden age of humanity, would make us finally independent of nature, independent of suffering, independent perhaps even of death. All that was needed was to extend our victories a little farther, to make our understanding and control of nature just a little more precise. And perhaps, the faithful opine, nanotechnology and genetic engineering will finally allow us to achieve that precision, to control nature on the molecular level in the same way we already ostensibly control it on the macro level. As one technology evangelist puts it, we would have an army of molecular robots and nano devices that would allow us to completely dominate nature. We now dominate it at a macroscopic level. We would then dominate it at a microscopic level, too. The paradigm of ever-ascending understanding and control represents a fundamental myth of our culture, which I call the ascent of humanity. Its culmination would be the totalization of that understanding and control, the complete mastery of nature. The myth goes something like this. Whereas in the beginning we were fully at the mercy of natural forces, someday we will transcend nature completely. We will control the weather, conquer old age, disease, and death, improve upon the cell and the gene, augment or replace the body with mechanical parts, download our consciousness into computers, even leave nature behind entirely by colonizing space. Consider, for example, the following futurist ravings. Quote, "The systematic application of nanotechnology, self-reproducing micro-miniaturized robots, armed with supercomputer processing power and ultra-sophisticated genetic engineering, perhaps using retroviral vectors, will cure the root of all evil in its naturalistic guise throughout the living world. And once the pain is gone, with the right genes and designer drugs, there's no reason why life shouldn't just get better. In the near future, a team of scientists will succeed in constructing the first nano-sized robot capable of self-replication. Within a few short years, 5 billion trillion nanorobots later, virtually all the present industrial processes will be obsolete, as well as our contemporary concept of labor. Consumer goods will become plentiful and expensive, smart and durable. Medicine will take a quantum leap forward. Space travel and colonization will become safe and affordable," close quote. The above quotes are from the far margins of futuristic thinking, but the underlying attitudes are alive and well, to wit. 1. That the answer to our problems lies in new technology. 2. That progress consists of increasing our control over nature. And 3. That someday our control over nature will be complete, or at least far greater than it is today, enabling the conquest of disease, reduction of work, lengthening of lifespan, space travel, and so forth. As recently as the 1970s and 80s, futurists like Alvin Toffler were writing that the greatest challenge facing society in the year 2000 would be how to use all of our leisure time. Today, analysis of the future of retirement routinely assume that people will be living longer and, thanks to medical technology, will enjoy greater health into their later years. Every day we hear about advances and progress, and although these words no longer bear the magical cachet they once did, we still wonder with anticipation what the next revolution in medical information or entertainment technology will be. Especially pronounced in the magazines like Wired, Discover, and Scientific American, the gee-whiz attitude about the future is everywhere, an ideology of progress written into our fundamental beliefs. What will the next wonder be? Where will Moore's Law take us next? Naive on the surface, the extreme opinions quoted above are merely distillations of a pervasive cultural myth that we are on the way toward fulfilling our destiny of rising above nature. That the words "the ascent of humanity" reverberate with a religious connotation is not surprising. Where else do we find the idea that our present age of suffering is only a temporary stage on the way to some perfect state of future existence? The myth of technological utopia is uncannily congruent to the religious doctrine of heaven, with technology as our savior. Thanks to the god technology, we will leave behind all vestiges of mortality and enter a realm without toil or travail and beyond death and pain. Omnipotent technology will repair the mess we have made in this world. It will cure all our social, medical, and environmental ills, just as we escape the consequences of our sins of this life when we ascend to heaven. And I've been reading from The Ascent of Humanity, the age of separation, the age of reunion, and the convergence of crises that is birthing the transition by Charles Eisenstein. To be continued. You can access this book online and other materials by the author at ascentofhumanity.com. And you can download an MP3 of this and all previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. Many thanks again to Sheffield Indie Media for the recordings of the Okanox Conference. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Like an unwell-